All right, let's pick it up then. First Regathering, Modern Israel, Session 35. We're on page 266 of your notebook. So let's take a quick review of where we've been getting to this spot. I didn't give you this map, but this is a map of Oslo II when the accord was signed. Approximately 85% of the West Bank remained under Israeli control, but the other areas were given over to the Palestinian Authority, the red areas of Palestinian cities, the yellow areas, Palestinian villages. More and more authority was being transferred slowly to the Palestinian Authority. Then we ran into the very unfortunate incident where Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, speaking at the rally at the Tel Aviv Municipal Building. Came down the stairs, and of course this is the memorial marking the place of the assassination. The key part of the memorial are these stones symbolizing the earthquake that shook up the Jewish world when it was learned that a Jewish man was the assassin killing a Jewish prime minister. A great shock to the Jewish world, and the assassin, of course, was Yigal Amir, a young Orthodox man. Now, the funeral was attended by many, many dignitaries from all over the world. This, of course, is a picture of the grieving family. And then some of the dignitaries, President Clinton was there, and Hosni Mubarak coming to Israel for the first time. Also, King Hussein of Jordan coming to Israel for the first time. Prime Minister Shimon Peres then became the acting prime minister and moved forward with the government. However, he was soon displaced by Benjamin Netanyahu from the Likud party. At that point, we entered into a review of the discussion about Zion and Zionism, because that debate was raging in the Jewish community, and it's still really raging in the Israeli community and Jewish community today. Is Zionism dead? So we wanted to take a look at what is Zion, what is Zionism. And after reviewing that material, we came up with this definition. The word Zionism describes a feeling. Zionism is an expression of the longing and yearning that the Jewish people have had in the past and still have for their homeland. As soon as any Jew expressed the desire to go back to his land, he was expressing Zionism. And that is a biblical definition. And that definition is supported by many sections of Scripture, but one key section is Psalm 137, 1 through 6, the entire psalm, communicates that longing the Jewish people have for our homeland. Well, the Labor Party was in disarray following the election by Likud of Benjamin Netanyahu, and Ehud Barak was then voted in as the leader of the Labor Party. He would have a big impact on Israel's politics in the years to come. All right, that pulls us into December 1997. And the anti-witnessing bill on the middle of page 266. Everybody there? I do want to go over this because this really impacted us in the late 90s, 1997, as we witnessed this and interacted with this bill here in America. Former Minister of Telecommunications, Shash, that's the Orthodox Religious Party, Shash, Knesset member Raphael Pinchazi, proposed to the plenum that it consider the presentation of a bill which would forbid all forms of proselytizing in Israel, as well as conversion from any faith to another. The subject was referred to further consideration to the Committee for Internal Affairs, which met January 13th, so this is 1998. The sum of its deliberation was as follows, page 267 at the top. Number one, the Jewishness of the State of Israel is paramount to its democratic commitments. Freedom to convert from Judaism is a threat to the Jewishness of the state. So how is that democracy? Well, it's not the same kind of democracy we have here. Freedom of religion in Israel is different from freedom of religion here. There is freedom of religion, but it's not the same. Two, missionaries are repeatedly accused of using illicit means. By the way, this is false. These accusations are false. Missionaries are repeatedly accused of using illicit means to procure promises of conversion. Therefore, restrictions must be imposed on their freedom to present their message. argument was there that the missionaries entice people to change their religion with monetary rewards, things like that. Well, that was not in the law. That was never in the law, and the missionaries never did anything like that. They're thinking back to Europe, where to become a Christian got you out of the ghetto, you know, and got you into the economic society in Europe. So this accusation of using illicit means was never accurate. Three, if a bill in the spirit of the discussion was presented to the committee, it would review it with favor. Four, the committee will ask the Attorney General to advise it in the course of its next meeting on the subject, as well as to which steps it should take and to what form such a bill could and should take. Eventually, a bill came under discussion by the Knesset by passing the preliminary reading in May 20, 1998. The terms of the proposed law forbid illegal possession of literature on which there is any form of effort to persuade another to change his religion. The proposed law further forbids the printing or copying of such literature. The proposal forbids distribution of information, tracts, books, or means of dissemination of information. The proposed law illegalizes any notice of an activity or literature in which an appeal is made for the recipients to alter their religious opinions. Finally, the proposal forbids any form of effort to persuade another to change their religion. Pretty comprehensive. You can't own any material. You can't copy any material. You can't distribute any material. You can't advertise about any material or have meetings in which an invitation is given. And you can't talk about conversion. Pretty stringent bill that was being considered. The penalty for breaking this law was set at 3 years imprisonment or 50,000 shekel fine. That's approximately, the shekel usually runs about 5 shekels of the dollar, so that's approximately 10,000 American dollars fine. Such a bill, if made law, would render illegal almost all evangelical activity in Israel. And that's exactly true. A protracted letter-writing campaign from around the world caused the bill to stall in the Knesset. Yeah, we were doing that. We were writing letters and sending, signing petitions and all kinds of stuff. Believers all around the world participated in this. So it stalled it in the Knesset, and being a private member's bill, when Pinchasi did not return to the Knesset, the bill died, much to everybody's relief. And so evangelism has continued in Israel legally and pretty much in an unrestricted way, with the Israeli believers taking the lead. You know, in the beginning, it wasn't the Israeli believers. They were kind of afraid. We were scared to death. A friend of mine with the Southern Baptists, he and his group really started this evangelism going by going out on the streets of Tel Aviv to hand out tracts. And they literally were ready to die. Jim and his friends thought, well, we're going to do this, but we're probably going to get mobbed. We're probably going to get beaten up. We may get killed. Okay? But they prayed, and they put their tracts in hand. They went out on the streets of Tel Aviv, and the secular Israelis loved it. They snatched up those tracts, and that gave courage to the Israeli believers, and they came out of the closet. They began to create messianic congregations and evangelism organizations, and evangelism by the native Israelis then took off. So it was really great. A Southern Baptist boy, Bill, started it all off. So anyway, did I see some hands? Yes. Pinchasi at the beginning of the article here. Telecommunications, Shosh, Knesset member, Raphael Pinchasi. He's the one who started the bill. Okay, Orthodox. He's an Orthodox member of Knesset. Yes.
But when we went to Israel with you, remember we went to that church, Peniel?
Yes, we went to Peniel, Messianic Congregation.
They had to have armed guards there.
Well, yes, because there's harassment by the ultra-Orthodox, private harassment. By the ultra-Orthodox, yeah. So there, we'll talk about that in a few minutes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's officially it's okay to evangelize in Israel, but that doesn't stop the Orthodox from their harassment. Okay. Yeah, it happens all over the place. Yeah, any place where there's an Orthodox community, and for example, Chosen People Ministries has set up their ministry office in an Orthodox community, there's going to be opposition, private, personal opposition from the Orthodox. Okay, all righty, let's see, page 1998, Israel is 50 on page 267. Let's just summarize that. Let's go to page 269. And we'll summarize that article. You can read that article on your own. But on page 269, there's a chart of the growth in Israel from 1948 to 1998. The first indicator is the total population. In 1948, there was 1,173,000 Jews in the land of Israel, and we made up 86% of the population. In 1998, 759,400, and the Jews only made up 80.5% of the population. So population increased tremendously, but our percentage of the population actually dropped from 86 to 80. Military tanks. At the height of its military strength in 1948, we had 80 tanks. In 1998, we had 4,300. A lot of tanks were built and imported there. Warplanes. At the height of our military strength in 1948, 55 warplanes. And in 1998, 4,488. And believe me, they weren't World War II Mustangs or anything like that. They were jets. Active armed forces in 1948, 45,000. In 1998, 175,000. Telephone lines, 17,000 in 1948. 1998, 2,539,000. A lot of people bought telephones, didn't they? A lot of people bought telephones. Private cars. 9,578 in 1948. In 1998, 1,174,166. So a lot of people bought cars, too. You can see Israel was prospering. People were coming into the country steadily. The country was beginning to grow and to prosper. And finally, native Israelis. This is what really is the most important statistics. In 1948, native Israelis, Sabras, those born in the land, totaled 26.3% of the population. By 1998, we were 61.2% of the population. So now half the population is born and bred in Israel, Sabras. So quite a change over 50 years. All righty, let's pick it up then on page 269, February 1998, pluralism fight. This is just a picture of the culture war going on in Israel. It's still going on today. It's an exciting place to live in many, many ways. Another indicator of the changes and struggles that impact daily life in 50-year-old Israel is the religious pluralism fight that rages. It is a literal culture war. From the Shomron News Service, Thursday, June 26, 1997, just a little earlier than that, Stop the Haredim demonstration. A planned demonstration scheduled to be held Saturday evening at Rabin Square, that's in front of the Tel Aviv Municipal Building, Tel Aviv, has caused an outcry by Orthodox and non-Orthodox members of the Knesset and public officials. The Chukala Yisrael organization has taken full-page advertisements in the newspapers and paid for distribution of billboards nationwide for the Stop the Haredim demonstration. The ads read, Stop the Haredim. They burn flags. They insult the IDF. They destroy our legal government system and take advantage of government funds. This cannot continue. This is our land. And that article sums it up. The secular Israelis, many of them, hate the Orthodox because the Orthodox have so much influence for being only 10 to 15% of the population. And so there is a good summary of why the culture war is going on. Another sore spot is the unwillingness of the Orthodox to recognize the legitimacy of the Reform and conservative branches of Rabbinic Judaism. This is highlighted by the controversial conversion bill fight that began in 1997 and continued on into 1998. So there's not only a fight against evangelism, but there's this fight within Rabbinic Judaism about conversion. In April of 1997, the Knesset passed the first reading of the bill giving the Orthodox establishment, notice these two words, sole authority over all conversions to Judaism in Israel. So if a person converts to Judaism, it's the Orthodox that decide whether it's a valid conversion or not. Sole authority. Okay? Notice the next sentence. The conservative and reform branches were incensed because the action cast doubt on the legitimacy of their Jewishness. See, if the Orthodox says that a conservative or reform person, is converted under a conservative reform rabbi, the Orthodox can still say they're not Jewish. They're not Jewish. So here, a conservative reform Jew says, does that mean I'm not Jewish either? You know? So they're incensed. Now, page 270, a committee, the Ne'eman Committee, was formed. It consisted of representatives from all branches of Judaism. The committee worked out a compromise consisting of a joint conversion institute. Notice the next sentence. Israel's chief rabbinate rejected the idea of working with non-Orthodox parties to create such an institute. So some people can get along, but when it comes to the top of the rabbinic pecking order, the Orthodox rabbinate said no. In Israel, the representatives of the Reform and Conservative movements said that with this ruling, the Rabbinical Council had declared war on conservative, reform, and conservative movements. Well, there's another article you can read there called Another Brick in the Wall. I'll let you read that on your own. But here's some pictures of that pluralism fight that still rages today. There is a classic picture that would sum it up. Here's this Haredi guy, and he's demonstrating. This is a Shabbat demonstration against any activity and sales on Shabbat. And look at that secular policeman. That sums it up. The two cultures in Israel just at each other's throat. And then here's another picture. Here was the Orthodox, the Haredim, were demonstrating in front of an Intel building because Intel was allowing some of its workers, I think, to work on Shabbat. And so they were demonstrating against that. And so here's this guy being taken off a little less violently by a couple of policemen. So that pluralism fight still is going on very much in Israel today. Very much. All righty. October 26, 1998, Y River Memorandum. Now, we're going to summarize this on the outline on page 271. You can read the paragraphs there, and that's the picture. Here's a picture of the Y River Memorandum being signed. You have it on top of page 271. On the left, you have Yasser Arafat. Next to him, you see King Hussein of Jordan. And notice King Hussein, he is undergoing chemotherapy at this time. See that? He will die shortly. He is very close to death at this time, undergoing chemotherapy. And of course, you can see the effect of the chemotherapy has had on him. Next to him is Bill Clinton, of course, signing. And then to the right is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. All right, let's take a look at the summary. The summary of the Y River Memorandum. Number one, a transfer of territory and redeployment of the IDF forces in two stages. Number two, a third redeployment committee will be established. Third, continuous combating of terrorism and its infrastructure. That never happened. Security arrangements. Fifth, Palestinian collection of illegal weapons. Six, ban incitement to violence. That hardly happened. Seven, reduction in the Palestinian police force to the size specified in prior agreements. Don't put together a Palestinian army, just a police force. Notice something that hadn't happened yet. Publicly nullify anti-Israel clauses in the PLO charter. That hadn't occurred yet. Permission to build an airport, seaport, and industrial park in Gaza. Page 72, top of the page. Page 272, excuse me. 10, safe passage between the West Bank and Gaza, and a 12-week timetable. There's another timetable laid out for you, another timetable that will not be met. So the meeting of timetables does not have a good history in the negotiations. Now, here we're looking at the chart. We're looking now at the column 3. Column 3 is labeled interim agreement, the very bottom of the chart. Remember Oslo 2, the Oslo Accords, or the interim agreement, was a comprehensive agreement on the transfer of powers and responsibilities in the West Bank and Israel to an elected Palestinian council as follows. We saw the... Whose phone is that? Did you guys do this to me? Just... Oh, I see we're going to... I hope there's some ice cream back there.
Come on,
I get to
ice cream.
I'll take one. All right, for you guys watching on YouTube, I have just been handed a Good Humor Sunday cone. Because the tradition here at Hadavar is if your cell phone goes off, you have to supply the class with ice cream. And they're doing it in good humor for me. Thanks, you guys. I appreciate this. Was this your idea, Lynn? If she wasn't a volunteer, I'd fire her. Okay. Well, but your clock was set a little bit early because this was supposed to happen right on the break. All right, I'll tell you what we'll do. Since we're all going to be distracted by our ice cream, we will pick up the chart after the break. So go ahead and take your break, okay? We're at the bottom of the chart. We'll pick it up again at the chart on page 272. And we're looking at the third column, the interim agreement. And we've been working our way through that interim agreement down the column there. So remember, Oslo II or the Oslo Accords or the interim agreement was this transfer of powers and responsibilities. And we've looked at the redeployment from Hebron. Now the White River Memorandum is signed. This is stage one of further redeployment to be implemented by November 20th, 1998. So that's the bottom square that's been added to column 3. So things are moving along. Not well, but they are moving along. Alrighty. Then November 1998, Reform and Conservative rabbis sit on a religious council. So that's just an indication of the pluralism fight that's still going on. The Knesset approved the Y memorandum. Then November 20th, 1998, the redeployment begins. The redeployment of Israeli troops from the Jenin area of the West Bank began after the cabinet voted to implement the first stage of the 12-week redeployment. So Israel is moving ahead with her obligations. All right, page 273. Again, we've seen that the late 90s were... a tumultuous time in Israel, especially for the believers, with that anti-witnessing bill coming before the Knesset. But now, the end of 1998, the ultra-Orthodox attack believers. The informal harassment by the ultra-Orthodox really ramped up in 1998, the end of 1998. The succession of attacks against Christians and Messianic Jews by ultra-Orthodox mobs has prompted local church leaders to call for better government protection for Israel's Christian community. Charles Kopp, chairman of the United Christian Council in Israel, demanded immediate action by Israeli authorities in late November to prevent ultra-Orthodox mob violence against Christians and Messianic Jews. Quote, "The current situation in Israel cannot be allowed to continue," he said. In November 28th, in a November 28th incident in the Negev town of Beersheba, rumors were spread in synagogues that Messianic Jews planned to baptize Jewish children. Now that's the key in the Orthodox thinking. In Orthodox thinking, you're okay until you undergo baptism. You get baptized, you're no longer a Jew, you're a Christian, you're one of them. So we don't allow baptism to happen no matter what. That's the thinking. They don't understand the biblical concept of salvation. So these Messianic Jews are going to baptize Jewish children. A mob estimated by police to number 1,000 Haredim, ultra-Orthodox Jews, started to surround a Christian and missionary church rented by the local congregation of Messianic Jews for their Shabbat, their Sabbath gathering. The 40 believers already inside the building could not get out, forcing police to evacuate them and provide protection from the crowd. Others, who were still outside, were blocked from entering. According to members of the congregation, they were pelted with stones, spit at, and many of their cars damaged. Angry demonstrators also attempted to climb the wall surrounding the building. Nata Aridan, a history professor at Ben-Gurion University, described the latest attack to the Jerusalem Post as reminiscent of anti-Semitic attacks in Eastern Europe. I witnessed a pogrom, he said. There can be no other word for it. Isn't that ironic? In Europe, it was Gentile pogroms against Jews. And here, this Israeli professor says, I just witnessed a Jewish pogrom against Jews. You know? And of course, he is probably was a secular professor. The siege lasted for about 3 hours. The crowd only disseminated after being addressed by local rabbis. Previously, the windows of a local Bible shop were smashed 4 times, and the shop itself set afire once. And here is some pictures of a December 24th, 2005 incident going on in Beersheba. This is the same area, same town. This is a little later now, in 2005, but there's a mob seen outside the Beersheba congregation. You can see all the ultra-Orthodox men gathered there protesting that this congregation even exists. And here is police speaking to the agitators in the mob. Again, this is in 2005, a few years beyond what we're reading about, but it's still going on. The Orthodox harassment of believers still goes on in many different forms, many different forms. All right, November 11th. Another ultra-Orthodox mob attacked the home of three Swiss Christian women in the conservative Mea Shearim neighborhood of Jerusalem, totally smashing their belongings. Only one of these three women was at home at the time of the attack, and she had to be escorted to safety by police under a barrage of stones and bottles. Ultra-Orthodox sources accused the women of missionizing, a claim the women denied. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported on November 29th that an American couple in Kiryat Malachi was attacked recently by ultra-Orthodox youth who suspected the couple of missionary work. The couple held that they were only involved in humanitarian work among Ethiopian immigrants. Page 274. Question? Hostilities are still going on. That's why when we visited Peniel congregation, they needed an armed guard to prevent, you know, ultra-Orthodox harassment. Okay. On November 11th, page 274. A member of a Nazareth congregation was also threatened recently. His front window smashed and silicone put in the door lock of their meeting hall, according to Messianic Action Committee Chairman Paul Lieberman. Of course, the silicone air is to prevent them from using the lock and therefore getting into their congregation. In Tiberias, Yad La'achim, an ultra-Orthodox anti-missionary organization, has denounced the Galilee experience to the Ministry of Tourism, accusing them of illegal missionary activity. They do present the gospel to Israelis, but it's done totally above board and legally. Galilee Experience has this great multimedia show of the history of the Galilee. And in it, there's a few minutes on Yeshua, a few minutes on Jesus. And the ultra-Orthodox can't stand that. And my friend Bill, who is now Bill Rogers, you've heard of him. He was once a shift manager there. And when at one time this ultra-Orthodox guy came in and paid his for his ticket and went into the theater, and he was the only one in there, and threw a firebomb on the stage. And fortunately, and then exited, of course. Fortunately, Bill was there on the spot, caused very little damage. But he tried to burn the place down, you know. And here is the Galilee Experience website. And They're located in this building right here, in the top of this building, right on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, the Kinneret. So they are presenting the gospel through this slideshow, and many soldiers come in and view it. A lot of Israelis come in and view it, and so the Orthodox hate them. Orthodox really have tried to get them out of there for many, many years. So when you go to Israel, go visit them and support them. They have a nice gift shop as well, so you can support the Galilee experience. All right, let's continue on. 1999, ultra-Orthodox attacks on believers continue. March 1999, assailants threw three firebombs at a house in Moshava Migdal near the Sea of Galilee. Police speculated that the reason for the attack was that a member of the house belonged to a Jewish messianic sect. March 1999, the Baptist bookshop in Jerusalem firebombed. March 1999, two incendiary bombs was thrown at the apartment of Yosef Shulam, head of the messianic community Nativya in Jerusalem. But on the bright side, two incidents are encouraging. June 1999, Yediot Acharonot reported that the leader of the attack on an apartment owned by Christians in Mea Shearim was sentenced to 18 months in prison. The judge ruled that the residents were attacked because of their faith. So you see, there is religious freedom in Israel. Legally, this all can happen. So this is all these attacks are done basically on a criminal basis by the ultra-Orthodox. You know, you can't just attack people. On August 1999, the Messianic Action Committee was officially recognized as an Israeli not-for-profit organization. The MAC led the fight against proposed laws meant to make Messianic Judaism illegal in Israel. Both of these bills failed to become law in the land. The recognition means that the Israeli government now officially recognizes Messianic Judaism. So among all that, still, the Messianic Jews, the Jewish believers, received recognition. All right, page 275, February. Now it's just a short time from the Y River Memorandum. Jordan's King Hussein dies. President Ezer Weizmann headed an Israeli delegation of 21 dignitaries who joined world leaders in paying final homage to King Hussein of Jordan. And here is the picture you have on page 275. King Hussein in happier days, healthier days. But he became a good friend of the state of Israel. He became a good friend. Haaretz reported that Weizmann, upon hearing of the monarch's death, depicted Hussein as one who was considered an enemy for many years, but who stepped towards peace at the right moment and time to become perhaps Israel's best friend in the Middle East. Radio Israel, Kol Yisrael, reported that the Jewish National Fund has decided to plant a forest in Israel in memory of King Hussein. Israel's stamp and medal agency announced that they will be issuing commemorative medal in honor of the king's memory. So, does that sound like an apartheid state to you? Where they're honoring an Arab king who was their enemy at once? Not exactly an apartheid state, you guys. He was succeeded by Prince Abdullah, and you have King Abdullah's picture there on page 275. Here he is, the current king of Jordan, King Abdullah, the son of Hussein. In March, Prime Minister Netanyahu began talks with Abdullah in Amman. Abdullah confirmed support for ties with Israel with the statement, "Peace is a strategic option for Jordan." And again, that peace treaty has still held up to today. May 1999, Barak landslide from Israel line. May 8, 1999. One Israel is a new political party that was started by Ehud Barak. It's really an alliance of labor and two minor parties. The three of them got together and they created One Israel. One Israel's leader, Ehud Barak, experienced a landslide victory over opposition leader Netanyahu. The margin of victory was 56% to 44%. That's a good margin. So the 57-year-old Barak will become Israel's fifteenth prime minister. And so you can, let's go to page 276. You can read more details about politics in Israel during that election. Notice on page 276, AIPAC, drops opposition to a Palestinian state. AIPAC stands for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. It's a lobbying organization, lobbies for Israel. So they dropped their opposition to a Palestinian state. All right, June. Clinton vetoes moving the embassy to Israel. That's happened. President after president after president has vetoed moving the United States embassy to the capital city of Israel. So Clinton did that as well. Hezbollah attacks continue in June. Remember, that's up north on the Lebanese border. Barak to connect Gaza and Hebron. He said, okay, you need connection between Gaza and the West Bank. We'll give you that. Then in July, Barak restarts the peace process. Prime Minister Ehud Barak called for a breakthrough on every front of the peace process within 15 months. He aspires for peace with Syria and Lebanon and a final agreement with the Palestinians by October 2000. Well, deadline after deadline after deadline is proposed, even today. All right, the Sharm el-Sheikh memorandum, another memorandum, comes out. After weeks of tough negotiations and a weekend of brinkmanship, Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian Authority Chairman Yasser Arafat signed a new West Bank land for security agreement, charting the course toward an historic final peace accord by September 2000. Barak and Arafat signed the modified Y memorandum, agreeing to a formula to implement the accord signed almost a year ago by the previous government, up on page 277. So somehow these accords just never seem to get implemented, do they? You know, we've seen that Israel tries to implement it, but they never seem to get implemented by their deadline. Under the new agreement, Israel and the Palestinians are to begin final status talks immediately with the aim of reaching a statement of principles on final status in 5 months and final status by September 2000. You know, again, if there was goodwill behind these negotiations, they all would have happened long ago. But there is no goodwill behind these negotiations. Events are now supposed to proceed rapidly. Within days, the army is to redeploy from 7% of the West Bank, transferring it from Israeli control, Area C, to Palestinian civilian control, Area B, and release 200 Palestinian security prisoners. Two more withdrawals are to take place on November 15, 1999 and January 20, 2000. And another batch of approximately 150 more security prisoners is to be released on October 8, 1999. During this time, the Palestinians will not declare a state. The southern safe passage route, that would be between the West Bank and Gaza, is to open October 1st, while the construction of the Gaza seaport is to commence the same day. Notice the next sentence. This is a mark it up moment. Hamas dismissed the accord as yet another sellout by Arafat and reserved the right to resist Israeli occupation. So that sums it up right there. The fundamentalists, the Islamic fundamentalists, oppose this every step of the way. Okay, we're now looking at the chart, and we're looking at the third column listed as interim agreement, and we have a new box appearing at the bottom. So Oslo II, a comprehensive agreement. We looked at the Sharm el-Sheikh memorandum. Now, the Sharm el-Sheikh memorandum talks about the release of prisoners, further redeployment, and safe passage. So that is the next step that's been renegotiated in the peace process, something that's never really happened. All right, page 278. September, final status talks resume. On the sixth anniversary of the signing of the Oslo Accord, remember, there's supposed to be a Palestinian state in 5 years. This is now the sixth year. Israeli and Palestinians officially renewed final status negotiations at the Eretz Junction. The timetable stipulated in the Sharm el-Sheikh agreement calls for a framework accord within 5 months and a treaty within a year by September 13, 2000. The final status accord is intended to provide a solution to the three most difficult points of contention between Israelis and Palestinians: borders, refugees, and Jerusalem. And we see those are still the sticking points today, aren't they? At this point, the total area under PA civilian or civilian security control is 36% of the West Bank, comprising approximately 5,500 square kilometers. So more and more territory has been given to the PA authority. Support among Palestinians for suicide attacks against Israel is waning, and support for the peace process has been rising steadily, according to the results of a Palestinian poll published on Sunday. So there's hope here in 1999. We'll see what happens to that hope. All right, November, population of Israel is 6 million. December, Israel and Syria agree to resume peace talks. Skip that next paragraph and go to 2000, right below it. Israel and Syria's peace talks resume and derail. Didn't last too long, did they? All right, page 279, top of page 279, German apology. I think this is worth noting. German apology. In an historic speech to the Knesset delivered in German, the first time that language has been spoken from the rostrum of the Israeli parliament, German President Johannes Rau declared yesterday, "I bow my head in humility before those who were murdered, those who have no graves that at which I could ask their forgiveness." Isn't that amazing? Here's a picture of the current year 2000, the current President Johannes Rau, as he came to the Knesset and uttered words like those. Rau arrived in Israel Tuesday for a four-day visit to Israel, his first as president of Germany, although he had visited the country many times in the past. Earlier in that day, Rau visited the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial, escorted by the institution's chairman, former Knesset speaker Sheva Weiss, a Holocaust survivor. The German president toured an exhibit of drawings and puppets made by children in Nazi death camps and laid a wreath. So that was great for him to come. This is a good time just to give you a little tour of Yad Vashem. If you go to Israel, you need to go to Yad Vashem. That's the Holocaust Memorial. This is the way it looks today. It went through an extensive reconstruction, and this is the way it looks from the air today. Inside, one of the exhibits is the Hall of Names. Inside this hall, you can see at the bottom of the picture there, you see what look like files. Those are files. They are trying to gather every name of every victim of the Holocaust. All 6 million they're trying to gather there. And so they're steadily working on that. Above the visitors, you see this archway, this column, and it contains a number of pictures of people who died in the Holocaust. Just to let you know that those files represent human beings. They're not just names. There's a close-up of that memorial. All these people, just a few of them who died in the Holocaust. As you walk the grounds, you'll see this cattle car. This is one of the cars used to transport Jewish people to the death camps, you know, shoulder to shoulder. No room to do anything except stand for days on end. Disgusting situation. One of the death camps. Inside, of course, the famous Hall of Memorial. And this is really considered a graveyard because there are ashes beneath the surface here. And of course, you see the names of many of the you see the names of the death camps: Dachau in the foreground, Bergen-Belsen, Auschwitz, and the Eternal Flame of burning. So when visitors, when dignitaries come, they usually come to the Hall of Remembrance and they lay a wreath symbolically in the hall. Yes, it is very carefully watched, and you are not to act out in any way there. When you're in there in the visitor area, you're to treat this as with respect and as a graveyard because of the ashes that are buried there. So yes, it is a place of of reverence and memory. So when you go to Israel, and you will go to Israel, visit Yad Vashem. But you can get caught up in, you can get caught up in that museum. When we were there recently, a couple got caught up in the museum. We were supposed to be back at the bus like at 4, and they still weren't there, and they still weren't there, and they still weren't there. So the Yad Vashem closes at 5, and I decided, no, we're going to wait for them. We're not going to drive away. So I went up to the guard, you know, in the entrance. Can I go back in and find this couple? You know, we're supposed to leave at 4, but, you know, I don't know where they are. And the guy says, don't worry, they'll be out at 5. This happens all the time. And sure enough, at 5 o'clock, they were escorted out along with everybody as they closed the museum. They had lost total track of time as they went through that museum. It is just incredible. If you wanted to go through it in detail, it would take you a couple of days. All these rooms and exhibits and all the documentation of the history of the Holocaust, you know, most of it is German documentation, German films, German documentation, German organization. They wrote it all down.
They wrote.
That's just the way the Germans are. They recorded everything. At the German organization, yeah. And a lot of it is German films of Hitler and et cetera, you know. It's just incredible. Where is it located? It's located in the western part of the city, over near Mount Herzl. No, in Jerusalem, yes. In Jerusalem, the western part of Jerusalem, yeah. Yeah, well worth going to. Question? Yes, yes. Good reminder. There are Holocaust museums around the country. You know, there's one in L.A. There's one in Houston. We visited that one. There's one, of course, in Washington, D.C., etc. There's Holocaust museums around the country. So it's always good to visit them. Of course, the Washington, D.C. one is supposed to be incredible, too. And, of course, Yad Vashem is very detailed. So it's good that more and more Arabs are getting to see this, too, because the Arabs are told the Holocaust never occurred. And yet it was the Germans themselves that documented most of it, in every detail, you know. Photographs, records, names of people. Yeah, it's amazing. All right, and so it was very significant that the German president would come and apologize, ask for forgiveness. Okay. PLO-Vatican Pact. That was just in February of 2000. That just dealt with the legal standing of the Catholic Church in Palestinian territories. Below that, Eichmann Journals. Let's just read a little bit of that. Adolf Eichmann's diaries, written while he was on trial and later awaiting his death sentence, were open to the public February 29, 2000 at the National Archive. At the same time that a copy headed for London to be presented as evidence in the case of historian David Irving's libel suit against American professor Deborah Lipstadt. Israel's moral obligation to help defeat a lawsuit challenging the scope of the Holocaust outweighed strong misgivings about publishing the jailhouse memoirs of the Nazi technocrat who organized the transport of millions of Jews to their death in the concentration camps, Attorney General Eliakim Rubinstein said. Irving says he does not deny that Jews were killed by Nazis, but challenges the number and manner of Jewish concentration camp deaths. Israel hopes the memoirs will provide more proof of the systematic killing of Jews by the Nazis, as well as the scope of the genocide. According to Rubinstein, Eichmann wrote that the killing of the Jews was the worst crime in history of mankind. The Nazi leader also provided details on the workings of the death camps, as well as insight into decision-making of the Third Reich, Rubinstein said. So quite a revelation from Eichmann himself. So you can read more about the Eichmann memoirs there on page 280. We'll drop to the bottom of page 280. And we get more negotiations. Multilateral track resumes after a three-year pause and goes on hold again. Remember, the multilateral negotiations were to prepare the Middle East infrastructure for the future. The steering committee of the multilateral negotiations of the Middle East peace process, in its special Moscow session, attended by foreign ministers, agreed February 1, 2000, to officially renew the multilateral track. The official activities of this track were halted 3 years ago as a result of a decision taken by the Arab League. Israel was of the position that the multilateral tracks constitute an integral part of the Madrid process. Remember the Madrid process? Two-party talks for peace treaties, multilateral talks to prepare the Mideast for the future. The renewal of the track will enable an entire region to prepare the institutional infrastructure required for an era of regional cooperation. But an Arab League meeting in Beirut, held after Israeli bombing raids, culminated in a call by the Arab states to delay a normalization process with Israel, including the multilateral negotiations. So things still crawl along, and a lot of it is due to the harassment in the northern border. And that is our next subject, page 281, IDF ordered out of Lebanon. Prime Minister Ehud Barak won a unanimous cabinet backing for his oft-repeated promise to end Israel's long military presence in Lebanon. The decision, read by Cabinet Secretary Isaac Herzog, reaffirms the government's goal of reaching an agreement with Syria that would facilitate a withdrawal, but emphasizes that Israel is determined to bring its troops back to the international border by July, even without Syria's blessing. Remember, Syria dominated Lebanon, and Syria has never signed a peace treaty with Israel. They're still in a state of war with Israel, technically. Barak vowed to the ministers that the Israeli Defense Forces would be deployed along the international border with Lebanon by mid-year, and added, "I don't advise anyone to test our reaction once we're deployed there." That's a veiled threat. We will react. Note, the Arab League blasted Israel's withdrawal plan. Israel's going to withdraw from Lebanon, and the Arab League doesn't like that. A joint statement, ministers of the 22-member League said they opposed the unilateral Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon and warned that such a move by Israel could lead to war. Their statement said that the Arabs strongly condemned Israeli occupation, and now they condemn pullout? Notice the confusion here. It's the Muddle East, you know? Their statement said the Arabs strongly condemned Israeli occupation, the recent airstrike, and the vicious Israeli threats to destroy Lebanon. It defended the Lebanese guerrillas fighting in southern Lebanon, saying, "The resistance is a result of the occupation and not its cause." Next paragraph, mark it up. In other words, Israel is damned if they do and damned if they don't. The obvious inconsistency of the Arab position reveals the self-serving nature and hypocritical attitude toward Israel they possess. "We don't want you in Lebanon, but we don't want you to leave." Isn't that crazy? Isn't that crazy? Page 282. April 5th, an Israeli Defense Forces official at the Northern Command confirmed that the IDF has begun making preparations for the withdrawal from southern Lebanon. March 8th, High Court and Justice rules that giving state land to Jews is illegal, ruling outrages right-wing and religious factions of the Knesset. March 21st, 2000, Palestinian track reopens in D.C. Go down to March 21st, Pope Paul II visits Israel. And here's a picture of him. You have a picture of Pope Paul II. This was a spiritual climax of his 22-year papacy. So you can read more about that. Let's see here. We're getting down to just a few minutes here. Where would be a good place to quit? Boy, right in the middle of the year 2000, huh? All right, let's go on at least to page 283. Notice this, March 21st, 6.1% of the West Bank transferred to the Palestinian Authority. So Israel is continuing to implement a phased withdrawal from the West Bank, as agreed. Israel handed over another 6.1% of the West Bank to the Palestinian Authority as part of the final stage of the second withdrawal. The transfer went off without a hitch. The territories include a large chunk of territory around Hebron, slivers of areas around Bethlehem, Ramallah, Nablus, and Jenin. They are under PA control around, and the area around, under PA control around Jericho was expanded. After the third stage redeployment of IDF troops scheduled for June, the Palestinian Authority will rule 60% of the Palestinian population of the West Bank, around 1.7 million people, in 6.5% of the West Bank. The June redeployment will add an additional 340 square kilometers to PA territory. So Israel is doing its best to live up to its agreements, but somehow the other side just doesn't seem to follow through. All righty. Well, I think we'll call it quits there. April 10th, Aliyah up 35% in 1991. So let's pick it up next year in January with the U.S. backing the Lebanon pullout plan. You can see, I think, through this series of material we've gone through that Israel in the past has made, I believe, a good faith agreements with the Palestinians. It's getting harder and harder and harder to live up to those good faith agreements because the deadlines never seem to be met. And we'll see Arafat and the Palestinians can continue going along this path. All right, let's close in prayer, and I'll turn you guys loose. Father, again, we just want to stop and thank you again for your oversight of Israel and your oversight of our lives. Lord, I do thank you for this class and these people and their kindness and friendship to me personally. So I lift them up and ask you to bless them and that this material will be a blessing to them and a witnessing tool for them throughout all their lives and with any Jewish person that you send across their path. So I do thank you, and I thank you in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty, you guys, we will see you on video next year. Questions?